I don't suppose it really did me any particular harm, because I just wasn't going to be able to bear that child anyway. And the Dr. Egret came along soon after I got up to Mrs. Innes's, and we tried and we tried and we tried until about midnight, and nothing happened. So then he knocked me out with ether, totally out, and somehow my baby was born. In any event, they brought her into me, and I knew there was something wrong with that child, and I just couldn't make out what it was. And her head was dreadfully pointed, and I didn't know that babies had fur on them, and her ears had fur all down them, quite long fur, and she had long black hair. And I worried for about 2 days, and I was just about in a state of collapse, when they explained to me that her left foot was collapsed because I had lost so much fluid when carrying her that she was squeezed so tightly that one little ankle couldn't properly develop. However, with exercises and things like that, we got that one straightened out. It was no problem. If they'd only told me right at the beginning. But they wouldn't unwrap her and let me see the rest of her body. And I was sure there was something really quite awful, because I had hated carrying her. I had just detested the idea. I didn't like a thing about it, Sarah, till I realized I'd born a little woman. Mm-hmm. And believe me, what a flood of feeling when you look down at this little woman and you realize, now look, she's not going through the sort of thing you've gone through. You're going to do it differently. Which was a resolve I very firmly made and tried to keep as best I knew how as she grew up.
Was there, in the Mission area, was there any kind of organization at that point? Were there any maybe farmers associations or women's groups or anything like that that you were part of or could be part of?
Oh, there was the Women's Institute. The Women's Institute is really a remarkably fine organization for rural women. I could also have been part of church groups. In fact, for a time, I was part of the Anglican Auxiliary, but my family was rather closely connected with the Anglican Church, but I was always a little dubious. But as a matter of fact, to please my husband originally, I joined the Anglican Church. I had been baptized in the Anglican Church as a youngster, and I was confirmed in the Anglican Church, which didn't take too well. When I was reading Anglican Church history, and I discovered how the Anglican Church had fought against the education of women, because it would make them not realize their place. And of course, too, you know, when you're semi-intelligent and you read that damned catechism or say it over again and over again, it's bound to get through to you that it says, among other things, that we should be pleased to stay in our proper places where it has pleased God to call us and not be rebellious, etc. And my father had a lot of material in his library, which was democratic socialist, you know, and I had a lot of these ideas in the background. And my stepfather's brother, Stanley Menhennig, had introduced me to the ideas of Annie Besant and Madame Blavatsky and that sort of thing. I'd done quite a little bit of reading along that line. I knew there were other systems of philosophy other than the Christian religion in the world.
So, but were you sort of isolated at that point in terms of having the kind of support in your community? Or were there people there who you could go to and talk to about
things? No, I was really somewhat isolated. And I was in a jam, you see, because I knew I'd made a mistake in marrying this man. And one didn't talk about this sort of thing. There was no point in saying anything to my family, because for a great part of them, marriage was still sort of a part of, you know, the church that you didn't attack. My mother did believe in the right of women to be divorced if they were unhappy in their marriages for good cause. However, she had already said to me, well, we didn't really want you to marry someone 17 years older than yourself, but you've made your bed. Now, don't you think you better lie in it? And that is an exact quote.
So what happened to you then? You had a child? You had a husband?
Did yeah.
You have a farm?
No, we had, he had a small garage in Mission.
Did you help him?
Oh, yes, I assisted him at the garage. I pumped gas and answered the telephone and, you know, did various things that were necessary, swept around the garage and all that sort of thing, which was totally without any remuneration. We had agreed, this was, of course, the Depression by this time, we had agreed that I could and would pay the telephone, buy our food, pay for the electricity on $20 a month. Now, $20 a month, of course, when I was out at Hatzik, employed as a housekeeper, had been, and I had $20 a month to myself, it had been quite a lot of money in those days. But it was very, very difficult to manage a baby and a household on $20 a month, but that was all that was forthcoming. There were times when I was actually hungry. I nursed this child right up until the time that she decided she no longer wanted to be nursed, which was 8.5 months of age. She just simply stopped. Mm-hmm. Had vast quantities of milk. I was an excellent milker.
Oh,
unappreciated. Let's stop there for a moment, eh?
You began to radicalize. What happened that you became active, and how did you become politically active? What influences were there in your life?
Well, I was an inveterate reader, as I have said, and I was reading, at that time, a lot of the literature that was available was rooted in the pacifist movement. And a lot of the literature that was available examined the First World War and the atrocious loss of human life in it. And as I said, my father had a number of these books, the muckraking books from Haldeman Julius and Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis. I had read The Jungle before I even moved down to Salt Spring Island, and my mother had said to me when she found me weeping uncontrollably over the conditions of these foreigners who were brought in to work in the meatpacking industry in Chicago, she had said, well, never mind, dear, they're only foreigners. Now, she'd wanted to, of course, alleviate my distress over the conditions of these workers, but it made me think more and more and more about how people earned their livings and how appalling. What appalling straits some people were put to, what inhuman situations, antisocial situations that people were put to. Even when I was a young teenager, you know, I thought this way. And of course, then discovering many different things as I went along, reading many different things. By the time I was in a horrible situation personally with a man I had no respect for at all, I was also open to many more ideas that were coming along. And in 1933, the CCF was formed, and of course, I felt a very strong and warm feeling toward it at that time. Even so, even though I had been exposed, though, to all these ideas and this rebellion on the part of women and a concern about the conditions of workers, I was appalled when some of the CCF people spoke of the royal family as being something that had to be eliminated from society. I thought that was absolutely dreadful, because again, you see, I presume this is some of this Anglican training coming out. But I joined the CCF, the precursor for the NDP, and I went from door to door collecting money for them. In those days, one collected a few pennies and maybe a nickel, and a dime was a big contribution to the movement. And
that was in the missionary?
In the missionary, yes. And I functioned in various executive capacities there.
Okay, how did you get involved initially in the CCF? How did you find out about it?
Oh, it was one of those wildfire things. It swept across the country from Saskatchewan in particular. And there were so many people in the mission area had come from Saskatchewan. So many of them were people who had come from England, who had Labour Party ideas. So it was hard not to be informed about what was happening. We'll need to stop here, eh?
Okay. What I'd like to start with today is to talk a bit about the conditions which led to the formation of the CCF during the Depression, the conditions that affected you and everyone around you, that made you and other people get involved.
Of course, it was a situation of such misery, be very difficult for young people to understand today. To understand on unemployed being expected to live on 25 cents a day first, that sort of thing, and that was to buy them cigarettes and tobacco and chewing gum, and of course it was impermissible for them to have any beer. When it came to the home, in the area that I was in, everybody turned to doing their own gardening. The conditions were just simply terrible. We went out and picked berries for a little bit extra. I carded wool and made quilts and sold them. I knitted for a little bit extra to eke out that $20 a month, which was all that I had to go on. And I also took a bookkeeping course and did a little bit of informal typing and bookkeeping, which I was paid for. But every place in the country, the men were without work. And many of them had to just walk away and leave their wives to take care of the families. And in those days, the families were fairly large nearly all the time. And it was, well, it was just a picture of abject misery. The only thing that saved the situation at all in the area in which I lived was the Carnegie Library was set up there. And I learned afterward that it was at the instigation of a group of members of the Communist Party of Canada who were living there. And the first librarian was Mrs. Holder, who was a member of the Communist Party. Well, this brought a great relief to many of us who could read. Again, you have to understand, we couldn't go to the movies. We had no TV. And some of us didn't even have radio. Some of us had radio. But we had a degree of social life. But most of us were too proud to admit to anyone else and too considerate of other people's pride to ever inquire as to just how abject the poverty was and how people were getting along. We just knew from our own condition how horrible it was. So when we heard that an organization like the CCF had been formed, we joined it in large numbers. I think maybe I said, in the last time we were talking, that I joined, and very soon I was in the executive. I was out collecting money. I was the treasurer, and we would collect our money at 5-cent pieces and 10-cent pieces. And even these, you see, in those days were not as significant in appearance as they are today. They were tiny little flat coins of silver. And anyway, the whole thing went to keeping the movement going.
What were the goals of the CCF that made it so attractive?
Oh, the thing that really, I think, dug right home was the statement in the Regina Manifesto that they would not rest content until such time as capitalism had been eradicated from the face of the earth. I think that probably is an exact quote. And that war, that the horrible social ills of war, of course, would be finished with the finish of capitalism. That was, you see, as I said before, it was a big pacifist movement at the time, and people were terribly anti-war.
What were the kinds of positions in the CCF program about women? Were there any particular positions?
No, there were no particular positions. Well, with this generality that men and women were created equal and should be considered equal, although different, the CCF definitely accepted the role of women in the family. But they also felt that women had a right to lives of their own. In the early CCF, and indeed all through the CCF, we had that remarkably fine woman, Helena Guttridge, who was a feminist from the early days, a very, very strong trade unionist, and a woman who really understood bureaucracy and the nature of the trade union bureaucracy, and who never came to terms with it. And there was Laura Jameson, who was more a do-gooder. She didn't understand so well, but she was a very fine person. Mildred Farney, Mildred Osterhout she was, and later she married a man named Farney. And there was Edith Lesueur, who was an odd sort of position she had. She was partly policewoman and partly social worker, but one who was very, very strong on protecting the rights of prostitutes and refusing to permit another member of the, in fact, the head of the organization, Dr. Lyle Telford. She laughed him to scorn for his attempt as mayor of the city of Vancouver to drive the prostitutes underground and to penalize them very severely.
Did the CCF do any work around birth control?
The CCF as such didn't, but members of the CCF did. Vivian Dowding in particular was very, very advanced in this sort of work. I did, quite a bit of work in my own way, in an informal sort of way. You have to remember at that time, even to give birth control advice to married women was considered a criminal thing. And one of Vivian Dowding's associates went to jail in Ontario for simply holding a small meeting of married women and enlightening them as to this. There were other aspects to the CCF too, like Dr. Lyle Telford set up a cooperative food, furniture, and old fertilizers and that sort of things we needed for the garden seeds. He set up a little food deal called Plenty for All. And the name of the organization exemplified the sort of populist spirit of the CCF.
What was the relationship with the trade unions? Were you aware of trade union organizing going on in the 1930s?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the CCF had a number of trade union locals affiliated to it. The United Mine Workers was one I recall. And then, of course, toward the end of the 30s, the union organizing became much more conscious, much sharper. It's a very strange thing how that very, very strong anti-war pacifist sentiment was turned around so quickly into patriotism and pro-war sentiment. The jobs that came along and the possibilities for earning what seemed like such immense sum, 75 cents an hour when you'd only been getting 25 cents a day, was very attractive. And at first the Canadian government had no need for conscription, because men were conscripted so willingly by their dire needs of their families and their need to get away from the terrible boredom of jobless living.
Mm-hmm. before the depression, were you involved in any of the struggles that went on, I mean, during the depression, in terms of unionists, like the Battle of Valentine's Year and the longshore workers, or the unemployed organizing, or some of the organizing of domestic workers? Or?
No, I was living in Mission at the time. Mission is a mission, it's actually, proper title was, the village of the city of Mission. And there wasn't a great deal doing there. I was in Vancouver at the time of the Battle of Valentine's Year. I had a nephew born at that time, the same nephew at the present time is the dean's assistant over at Christ Church Cathedral. I know the Battle of Valentine's Year very well. I fed, as they went through Mission, many of the unemployed. And I collected food out in Mission and made jam and bread and that sort of thing and sent in to the people who were occupying the post office. But I was only one of dozens and dozens and hundreds of women who did this sort of thing.
Were the conditions very bad for trade union organizing during the Depression?
Oh, sure. They were very, very bad for the organizing because, there just was no work at all. And the old craft unions were job trusts, you see, and they didn't want anyone else moving in on their jobs. Strangely, I don't remember. Now, I don't recall, but there well may have been right-to-work movements at that time, but I don't recall them at all.
Did you have any contact with the Workers' Unity League or the Communist Party during the 1930s?
I had contact with members of the Communist Party. I knew there were members of the Communist Party, and I was asked to join the Communist Party, but there was something about them that I didn't like. At that time, although I wasn't fully aware of it, I knew there was a man in the CCF. Some of these Communist Party members were in the CCF, by the way, but one knew they were Communist Party members. Mrs. Holder was one, the village librarian. But they were very pleasant, agreeable people. One could work with them quite reasonably. But no, there was no Workers' Unity League out there mm-hmm. at all. But we all got behind the struggle of the unemployed, you see, and we worked together with one mind, really, in that struggle.
Why did you decide not to join the Communist Party if you were interested in the youth?
Well, because for one thing, I can't remember the name of a man who is alleged to be a Trotskyist, who was in the CCF organization out there. And I was revolted at the way they treated this man and the way they shouted him down and that sort of thing. And probably it was in part, my petty bourgeois training, my middle class training, that one does not treat other people impolitely. That did it, but at the same time I had read one thing of Trotsky's about in the little 5-cent Liberty magazine about how America will go communist, and I knew that this wasn't all wrong, that there was something that was right about these people, but I did not, and I when I refused to join the Communist Party, I was immediately called a Trotskyist by them. And I was immediately on a different social footing. So that it really bolstered my feeling of disquiet about the way they were working.
Okay. You had been, when the war started, you were still living out in Mission?
That's right, yes.
Did you at any point get a job?
Oh, yes.
Can you talk about your job and the...
Oh, certainly. Yes, I had my first opportunity for a real job that would pay more money than my $20 a month doing housework. And it was at the local canning factory. And we were canning vegetables. At the time that I went in, we were canning green beans. And I went on the night shift, second shift and night shift, because that meant that I could leave my daughter with my husband when he had finished his work, or nearly finished his work, and then I could more or less keep an eye open for her during the day, you know, one eye at least. So, yes, I went into the canning factory, and it was very interesting right from the very beginning to work in a social atmosphere. I'd never done that before. And we were canning beans, and we had to grade the beans, sort the beans, and they were on long belts. And that's the first time that I had read about speed up. I had read the Flivver King and different things about Henry Ford's speed up, you know, and the ingenuity of it. That's the first time I experienced it. And it's the first time that I experienced the way the grapevine goes through, how nights when the boss who would step over and twist the machine so that it went just a little bit faster and then a little bit faster again, how the word would go from one belt line to the next of just let them go, and they would all go right down to the end and they'd all have to be picked up and put through again. So I really enjoyed that. And I don't know how long I continued there. I went through the peach canning also. But I was never told directly that there was any organizing going on. Now, that could have been because I was suspect in the eyes of the Communist Party. For I imagine the Communist Party people there would be the ones who were doing the organizing. But on the other hand, it could well be that there just simply wasn't any organizing of that operation going on at the time.
I remember we once discussed how there was some industrial action that took place while you were working there. Can you describe
that? Well, that was the business of speeding up the machines, speeding up the belt lines. And the word was just passed from a woman who was a forewoman down at one end of this enormous building, went right through us so quickly that let them go, let them go, let them go. And we knew that meant just refuse to sort at this speed, that the pressure wasn't going to come on us in that fashion. And so we just simply let them go, and they went into the big bins. They had to take them back and put them through all over again. And there was virtually nothing they could do about it.
How did you feel seeing that kind of...
Oh, elated. I felt absolutely enormously elated. I was delighted with it. We also did a lot of talking at lunch hour about the fact that we took out the small tender beans to be canned whole for the officers, and all the big coarse ones, nothing was wasted, were chopped up for the infantry, for the general line of troops. Yes, it was a very interesting, most interesting experience to me. I'd had little contact with unions in the sense that most of my women associates were with the CPR. Their husbands were in the CPR brotherhoods and that sort of thing. And I knew a union carpenter or two in Mission. But there was nothing doing in that rural community. I learned something about cooperatives there, too, because the people I had worked for were in the FVMPA, the Fraser Valley Milk Producers Association, which has gotten worse and worse and worse. But even in those days, it was obvious that cooperatives were not the answer to the ills of society.
In what sense?